It took the movie Schindler's List to create mass awareness about Nazi atrocities against Jews in World War II. If the Nazis needed a role model for their work in attempted genocide, cultural and spiritual, it may have been the United States government and its treatment of the indigenous peoples of this continent. Another Hollywood effort, Dances with Wolves, may have started to tell the story that white America may not want to hear. But the story is told in great detail through the eyes of one Indian activist in his new book, Where White Men Fear to Tread. The author is a longtime American Indian Movement activist, actor, and lecturer, Russell Means, and it's our honor to have him as our guest today. Russell, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
An amazing book. I mean, there's just so many things. As I was telling you before the interview, I have enough questions probably for about 4 or 5 hours worth of interviews, but we'll do the best with the time that we have, and we appreciate your time today. The first question I often ask authors is, what was the first creative spark that became this book, or why was it important for you to get your story out at this time?
Excuse me. Well, actually, it was 3 years ago, and a man by the name of Murray Fisher, then an editor at Playboy magazine, wanted to do a Playboy interview with me. And I said, all right. He came out to the Navajo Reservation. We sat around for 3 days. And he tape recorded me. And then he started telling me, listen, you know, your story has to be told. Well, I thought about it. And he convinced me because he had been the editor for the autobiography of Malcolm X. He had also edited Alex Haley's Roots. So he knew what he was talking about. And after duly thinking about it, I decided to do it.
There's a lot of controversy over what we should call Indians. Should we call them Native Americans, the first people? But there's some, I guess, misinformation about the term Indian itself. It's not people from India, but it has a different meaning. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Right. In 1492, the maps of the world and the names of the geographic areas of the world, there was no such place as India. The subcontinent of what is now called India was referred to as Hindustan. Now, if he was looking for Hindustan, I imagine it would be called Hindis or some such thing. But he wasn't. He was lost. We discovered him. And he set in motion the Columbian legacy, which is his first policy of Indian policy was relocation and or extermination. But what he wrote in his ship's log was, una gente indios, a people in with God, who were so trusting and generous as it to be a fault, therefore they would make excellent slaves. That's what he wrote. But the English bastardized those two Spanish words, indios, into Indian, or Indians. And I'd much prefer to be called Indian until we free ourselves. Then we can call ourselves anything we please.
There are a lot of stories in the book that, obviously, it's the Indian point of view. And one of them, you know, when I read it, I was sickened by it, quite frankly, and that's the story of Thanksgiving, something that we celebrate, one of our most revered holidays, one of my favorite holidays, until I read what it was really about. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Wow. Yes, back in the early 70s, the Wampanoag people, who still live in and around their ancestral homeland, which is Martha's Vineyard and the Mashpee, that whole area around Plymouth Rock in Plymouth, Massachusetts, they uncovered a historical document in the archives of Massachusetts that stated it was a proclamation issued by the then governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that a village near and around Plymouth, a European village, had went out and massacred an Indian village of men, women, and children and came back. And so this governor proclaimed a day of Thanksgiving and urged other colonies to do the same, to go out and kill the heathen savages, massacre them, and then have a day of Thanksgiving. So that was the first Thanksgiving. That's what that was all about.
So I guess our tradition of football almost replicates that in a sense.
I would imagine so.
Yeah. There's stories from your personal life that the racism just screams out. In fact, in the days before affirmative action, you were fired simply because you're an Indian.
Right. I was the office manager for EF English Construction Company out of Hutchinson, Kansas.
Let's make sure we get a plug for them.
Well, I don't know if they're still in existence. You know, I really don't. It was a family-owned business. And this was back in the 60s. But at any rate, yeah, because I really liked their chief engineer who hired me to put together his office. And then after working there 2 weeks, he came to me and he said, listen, and this was in Hot Springs, South Dakota, just up the road from Rapid City, South Dakota. Now, one has to first understand that South Dakota is the most racist state in the Union, bar none. And what he came to me and told me, he said, the powers that be in Hot Springs and at the hospital, it was a veterans hospital, and an old fort, and they were tearing down some of the old horse barns to put up another wing to the hospital. And he said, listen, the powers that be, the white men in this area, don't want an Indian bossing or being in charge of white people. So I'm going to have to lay you off. And he did.
The concept of work from a Eurocentric point of view and from an Indian point of view is quite different. And you know, there's a lot of, I guess, reevaluation with people who have jobs that there's no soul connection. But with Indians, their work always had a soul connection. Maybe you can show us the difference between work from a Eurocentric point of view and an Indian point of view.
Well, we don't have work. There's no such thing as that concept is not in any indigenous person's realm of reality. Work is a separation of life. We have a way of life. And that way of life includes everything that you're responsible for. You know, as bad as that we cannot understand work, you know, trying to understand what vacations are all about is even more difficult. I mean, that concept, where does that come from? Taking off from things you're supposed to do. I'm sorry. It has no meaning to me. I mean, an escape from your responsibilities. Get real.
We're talking with Russell Means, Indian rights activist, actor, and author of Where White Men Fear to Tread. I'm Paul Nelson. There's also a lot of controversy about Indian mascots and nicknames, and I didn't know till I read the book that the first protest against Indian nicknames and mascots was something that you did when you lived in Cleveland.
Right, I was executive director of the Cleveland American Indian Center, and I was the point man in our collective effort at the center. We decided to sue the Cleveland Indians baseball team because of their racist mascot, Chief Wahoo. And we did. And it was the longest civil lawsuit in the history of Cuyahoga County, which is the county that Cleveland sits in. Now, that was settled out of court by Indian people who eventually took over, because everyone that sued, we left. We went back home to the res, and the ones that supplanted us settled for a monetary settlement with the Cleveland Indians and allowed the Cleveland Indians to keep their name and mascot. But yes, we don't want to be mascots anymore. You know, that's institutionalized racism. I mean, imagine the New York Yankees being called the New York Jews or the Washington Redskins. And that redskin, that's the same thing as being called either a kike or a nigger to me. And to be called the Washington Niggers, the Atlanta Negroes, it's blasphemy. It's inhumane. Why?
You know, the Indians themselves were named in honor of an Indian who played baseball back in the 1890s. Does that make it any better for them to be able to use that? I guess having the goofy mascot is probably not, but you know, you thought that in the beginning there was a seed of something positive?
You know, the word Indian, as you know, does not bother me, as we said at the top of the program. In fact, I prefer it. It's the mascot, Chief Wahoo. I'm sorry, you know, no. When the blacks got rid of little black Sambo restaurants, and you don't see the Frito Bandito anymore, that's because those peoples have been emancipated economically in this country. We Indian people, we are forced to live in enforced poverty. So consequently, there are no considerations about who and what and why we are. And that's why they do. You know, Jack Kent Cook and the owner of the Washington Redskins, and that other idiot, Turner, who's owner of the Braves, they're so callous that even Ted Turner does the tomahawk chop on national TV continuously.
Along with Jane Fonda.
Exactly. And what that has now become, at least in the Northern Plains, up in the Dakotas and eastern Montana, it's become another obscene gesture that the racists employ. Whenever they see us now, instead of flipping us the finger, they do the tomahawk chop. So thanks, Ted Turner.
Have you had conversations with Ted Turner? I mean, his network put on a series of programs on Native Americans.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead, comment on it.
Well, the series of programs are atrociously, not only artistically, but anything else. They're just bad. And I hope that my people have shut down their latest effort called Crazy Horse.
You know, when we talk about movies that have historical inaccuracies, a lot of Indians have a problem with Pocahontas. She wasn't, didn't have a love affair with John Smith. She was raped by him. She certainly didn't have the kind of cleavage that the cartoon Pocahontas has. And there's been a lot of, in fact, I read a lot of comment on the internet about objections to Pocahontas. And yet you were in Pocahontas, the voice of Chief Powhatan, which my 4.5-year-old daughter just absolutely loves. What are your thoughts about that?
First of all, you know, I laughed at these dysfunctional Indians who criticize Pocahontas, or anyone else that could criticize Pocahontas.
Are these hang-around-the-fort Indians that would criticize it?
No, not necessarily. They're just people who are ignorant. And ignorant of where they come from and why, and don't even know anything about their origins. Now, I don't accept a role unless it's good for the children. My first consideration in doing Pocahontas was, how are the children going to walk away from the film? What are they going to feel? You partly answered that question. And you're a non-Indian, and so look how positive. But let me say this first before I say anything more. Pocahontas is the finest movie ever done about Indian people in the history of Hollywood, bar none. And the reasons are this. Now, I researched my role after I got it, and I discovered 11 different stories about Pocahontas, okay? Now, let me also say this. Disney did not make a documentary. Let's get that straight.
It's a cartoon.
Exactly. It's a cartoon based on history. Now, everyone agrees there was a Pocahontas. Wasn't a real name, but there was a Pocahontas. She's known by that, even then. There was a John Smith. There was a Jamestown. She saved his life. Where's the lie? Now, the 7 of the 11 stories that I discovered were written after that time, after 1620, 1640. After then, after 1650, the other four were written during her time and John Smith's time. Two of the stories written by John Smith. All right. Only one of those four stories contained anything about the romance. And that was written in England by John Smith. His memoirs from when he was in Jamestown do not mention Pocahontas at all. And do not mention the life-saving. But it does when he was back in England. The other thing is, the two other people who wrote about Pocahontas were in the village at the beginning. And that's when they first noticed her, because she was the daughter of Chief Powhatan, who headed up the Powhatan Confederacy. Now, Chief Powhatan, of course, was a great and gracious man, as proven by the very existence and longevity of Jamestown. So they noticed her, and she was... that was before puberty, and she ran around naked and played with the boys of Jamestown. That's what they wrote. Excuse me. That made her 10 or 11 years old, and that's what they estimated her age. When John Smith wrote his recollections while he was in England, that took place 4 years later, his life-saving, 4 years after the time of those other two authors, okay? So now that makes her 14 or 15. If you know anything about indigenous lifestyles anywhere in the world, and even in peasant communities around the world, women are considered women after puberty. They even go through the puberty rites. They have ceremonies welcoming them into womanhood. They are eligible for courtship at 13, 14, 15 years of age. They're usually married by 15 and have a child at 16. Now, there's another reasons, physiological reasons for this that affect the generations and the health thereof, but that's another for another interview and another book. What Pocahontas was the right age to be courted. Now, in indigenous communities, you are not eligible for courtship as a male until you are firmly on your path. And you can afford not only a wife, but you have to also demonstrate that you can afford a child along with the wife. Okay? So you're always in your late 20s, early 30s when you enter courtship as a male. So it was correct. And I saw this with my own eyes, but down in Nicaragua, when I was among the Indian villages down there who still live the way they always have. Okay? This is just fact. It's indigenous fact. So those people that are complaining don't know where they come from and don't know their history.
What about Disney profiting off a story about Indians? Does Disney have some kind of responsibility to take some of the riches that they're getting from this movie, from the merchandising? If I had a nickel for every Pocahontas gym shoes or plate set that my daughter has, we'd have quite a lot of our money back. Doesn't Disney have a responsibility to Indian communities to give back some of that wealth?
Why?
They're using a story about Indians.
It's a history. It's about white people, too. You mean white people have to give back to Disney also, or Disney have to give back to white people? You know, if anybody should complain, it should be English. You know, the English, I mean, they're totally denigrated, and it should be white men. I mean, here's this savage woman who teaches this lunkard, this dumbcuff, John Smith, all the lessons of life in this movie. I mean, what more could an Indian want? Here's this woman teaching this European male the lessons of life and written realities thereof. I mean, the guy was pretty dumb. It showed his ignorance. He didn't marry her. He left.
Well, as I said before, my daughter absolutely adores this. In fact, if you ask her what her name is, she'll tell you it's Swan Princess Pocahontas Rebecca Rose Nelson.
My 15-year-old daughter, who, by the way, is physically exactly, looks exactly like Pocahontas.
Beautiful girl.
Tatewe. Yes, she just won Miss South Dakota Teenage USA. That's a heck of an accomplishment in the most racist state in the Union. I mean, it's a breakthrough. Wow. Now, when I took her to the premiere in New York City, at Central Park, after we were walking away from it, I said, what'd you think? She said, I liked her strength of character. All right, that's good enough for me. If that's what she took away from that movie, an Indian girl, young Indian, my daughter, she's in the American Indian movement. She's demonstrated. She caused the changing of her own junior high school mascot name, you know, when she was in junior high school. Now she's in high school. I'm very, very proud of her. She wants to be a pediatrician when she grows up. She's discovered one source of the cause of the disease lupus, and nobody knows the other sources. She's discovered the only source so far that causes the disease of lupus. Now, if she can walk away from that movie and say that strength of character in that cartoon, what more can I want, and what more can Disney give back?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have no problem with free market economics. I love free market. I'm an accountant by trade, you know, and a computer programmer. So, and that's in the book also. So I have no problem with free market economics. You know, if the Indians are crying around and they want something dizzy, go out and make your own movie, make some money.
One of the subjects that they might want to make a movie out of is the story about the only nation that made the U.S. government beg for peace. And we're talking about the Lakota under Red Cloud. We have a couple more minutes. Maybe you can tell us that story.
Ah, Red Cloud. Yes, it resulted in the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, what Wounded Knee was all about, and what everything I'm all about is treaty rights and the Constitution of the United States. But Red Cloud militarily defeated. They begged for peace, and the result was the 1868 Treaty. And to show our generosity, we allow them to write the treaty in their own language so the white man would make sure that he would understand it. You know, we didn't dictate the terms. We said, you write it so you can understand it. And they agreed to every one of our conditions, okay? That treaty agrees to every one of our conditions. The only thing is we provided a buffer zone between us, our territory, and the United States of America, which, of course, they violated 3 years later.
Well, we're out of time for our first part. We're going to have more with Russell Means in part two next time. Russell Means has been our guest, American Indian Movement activist, an actor, accountant, computer programmer, and author of Where White Men Fear to Tread.